Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So, it's today Wednesday or Thursday? Thursday? So that's 4 days? 4 days of meditation? I don't think anyone finds this easy. So although we call it a retreat, it's not running away by any means. It takes a lot of courage and determination. Most practitioners find particular ways where they learn how to stabilize the mind. And that's an important part of the exercise of meditation, learning to take a theme or an object of meditation and just go through the exercise of stabilizing, stilling, calming, and get good at it. Just become quite proficient at it. But the way one does that is so varied. So many ways to attempt to do that. So just reading Lumpo Liam's use of asubha meditation, a skeleton, visualizing a skeleton. Then if you think about Lumpo Sumedho, he uses the sound of silence. It's much different. So there are some of the classic ones that you hear about, like anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness with the breath, recollection of the breath. And that's a like if you're ever bored in meditation, just watch your breath. Something to do. And just learn to just go through the exercise of stabilizing the mind, just to learn how to stabilize the mind with no big deal around it. Just like any mundane thing you learn how to do, you just have to go through the exercise. If you if you want to use a hand planer, you have to learn how to sharpen the blade. So you just take a stone and you sharpen and sharpen and you get it. Sharpen the blade. And then you can plane a piece of wood because the blade's nice and sharp. Well, to some extent that's what the sort of stabilizing practices are about. To bring composure and clarity to consciousness. So classically the breath, Lumpo Sumedho, he often talked about the sound of silence. He found that quite powerful. So he would say to me, just hold that sound for the count of 15. Stabilize the mind in the count of that 15. Or when you feel a strong emotion, listen to the sound of silence. Stabilize the mind with the sound of silence. So again, I guess I tend to just put questions back to you. Like, are you confident with some way of stabilizing the mind? Do you understand what that means, first of all? What that might mean? Have you tried to consistently train in a particular way of stabilizing the mind? Or do you just sort of kind of hopscotch around here and there? Or do you think you can't stabilize the mind? It's hopeless. And where do you fit in there? But I think it's pretty clear that that's a necessary part of training the mind. And sometimes we're too tired or we're too emotionally confused to do any kind of formal practice. If someone dies, there's grief, or you're in extreme pain, or whatever. But the times where there isn't anything extreme, when life is kind of in the middle, nothing too bad going on, nothing too good going on, then to make time to train in stabilizing the mind is a very necessary part of this life. And it is something that, like Ajahn Sona says, it's not just quality time, it's quantity time. You have to put the time in. And I think we've all seen, if you don't sustain a meditation practice, then that the skill of that can kind of become rusty, and you forget how to do it, or your mind becomes much more coarse and restless. So part of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration is the sustained stability of the mind, doing that again and again and again. And within that, you learn about the hindrances that come up, and you develop a foundation. You develop various kinds of paramitas, don't you? Various kinds of virtuous qualities, which are a foundation for understanding more deeply, going more deeply into the silence of the mind. One of the ways to stabilize the mind is to use imagery, and one of the images which is very popular is the image of a wheel and the hub of the wheel. So imagine a bicycle wheel. You have the rubber on the outside, you have the spokes leading to the center, and then you have the axis. And then awareness is like the axis, and then the rim of the wheel is like the sense experiences: hot, cold, good, bad, pain, pleasure, memory, feeling, thought. They're all on the outside, spinning around, moving, changing. And this is just a metaphor. You can use imagination to work with stilling the mind. So if we go out to the rim, of course we spin around. So I was using that image today because I've been doing stomachs today. So I had this just kind of perfect kind of pain. This is for meditation, because it's unpleasant, but it's not like a really searing pain. It's just enough cramping to be good for practice. The Buddhists do things like this. And I was just using that image of the pain in my stomach was like the rim of the wheel, and then I just kept asking myself, so where's the still point? Or what's the still point? And then I would drop the question, and I would just kind of try to be that still point. And the pain kept pulling my attention, so like the spokes of the wheel pull you outwards. And I just, because it's a strong sensation, isn't it? Very strong sensation. And then just go, where's the still point? Where's the still point? And so trying to develop stillness around the unpleasant. Now what that does, first of all, it makes the sitting doable. Right? It's not like a total restless agony. It's okay, it's not a problem. The mind's quite peaceful after. But perhaps more so, it also informs consciousness in a kind of intuitive way. That with any unpleasant experience, there is a still center. And I think the mind becomes kind of educated to that in an intuitive way. Because if I can do it with something like stomach pain, I can do it maybe with a difficult emotion. So some some emotion is triggered off in me, it's very strong, and the mind wants to go there with fascination or with thought. And then if I have enough presence of mind to say, okay, this is the emotion, and where's the still point? Where's the still point? And each time I find the still center of being around strong sense experience, that creates a foundation for liberation, a foundation for enlightenment. Because it's this pulling of sense experience, this fascination and aversion and obsession with thoughts and emotions and so on, that keeps us spinning around the wheel. If we just look at practices like just something about me getting something right now, like an immediate experience of pleasure, an immediate experience of peace, or some kind of insight right now, and we don't see that the practice of developing the mind is something that is actually quite layered and quite foundational. If we don't see that, then we feel very frustrated with a difficult sitting or a difficult situation. But if we see it's just this opportunity to develop paramita, opportunity to develop virtuous qualities, and the opportunity to develop foundational things, then I think we're much more sober and much more mature, maybe, in going with this experience. If we simply think, well, this experience is a nuisance, if I didn't have this experience then I could meditate, then we really lose the plot. But meditation is this experience, whatever it be. And the challenge is to no longer seek another experience or seek something some kind of compensation for the experience we have, but to try to be mindful of this experience just the way it is. So the reading from Lompo Liam, then, and he makes that final kind of question to himself, and why do we practice? We practice for the sake of practice. And if you understand the whole the emphasis on non-desire, the emphasis on non-becoming, non-anticipation, just the present moment, then it's not just a kind of simplistic question and answer. It's a quite profound answer he comes to. It seems very simple. We practice for the sake of practice. But it's very hard to practice for the sake of practice when you have like pain, emotional pain, physical pain, because you're practicing in order not to have the unpleasant. And if you have had experiences of bliss or deep silence, it's very hard to practice and not try to get those, not to have this underlying desire to attain to something. So practicing for the sake of practice, practicing just to train the mind to be patient with this hour that I'm sitting now, the heat in the body, the sound of the chainsaw, the restlessness of my mind, whatever it is, just the way it is, just the way it is, just the way it is, that continual refrain. And then that goes against the desire mind. The desire mind, which always wants interesting, exciting, and doesn't want painful, boring things. And so we develop the ideas around the paramitas. And I think on the paramita patience is certainly the the kind of great failing we most of us have in our meditative life. Because we don't see any profit of just being here with something which is very ordinary. It just seems so uneventful and uninteresting and uninspiring just to be kind of sitting here and nothing great is happening, a few thoughts in the mind, and so on. And as that reading that I had, in that kind of blankness, in that kind of nothing much happening, we need to have a lot of patience. Otherwise, the mind never opens to silence. It's always objectifying, going out into the hub of the wheel, going out there. And the more sort of nebulous the mind states are, like doubt or not being sure or nothing much going on, seems like we're not getting anywhere. You know, we start to doubt, thinking, am I getting anywhere? I'm not getting anything from this practice. And so self-view arises, and self-view is very much ego, self, craving. And if we believe in that, then of course we're lost again. So that's quite a, I use that image quite a bit. I like to use that. And the other image that you find, the kind of metaphors of space and form, you've heard that many times. But that also is the use of imagination, rather than just intellect, or just the body. It's the use of the kind of image of space and form. So space is, again, if you want to notice forms, then you look at me, you look at color, you look at the trim around the windows, you look at the pictures, you look at the fan, you feel the fan, you feel the heat. So these are all forms or objects in which we usually pay attention to. So you come into a room, what do? First thing, you look at the Buddha, right? And then you see who else is here. Maybe you notice the flowers. Oh, flowers are nice, or the flowers need changing. So the mind is naturally very attracted to forms. If the water hadn't been changed and the smell is foul, you'd notice that. Or our toilets out here. So that's what we pay attention to. We pay attention to forms and objects. But we don't tend to pay attention to space. So what would I have to do to notice space? Well, that's much more subtle. To notice the space, if you just do it right now, if you notice the space in the room, you have to stop engaging with objects. You have to stop thinking, because that's an object. You have to stop kind of focusing on it. You have to kind of soften your gaze, stop focusing on any object. And you have to kind of relax your attention, you know, the space. But you can't define space like you can a picture. You say, well, there's a tomato and there's a brown frame around it. It's a black and white sepia tint picture. In space, it doesn't have that kind of definition. And it really doesn't depend on the walls, does it? I kind of not really define that. And yet, space is a part of this experience. So you kind of play around with that idea and then you try it out. You just kind of sit here and try it out. There's space, form. And then you take that metaphor and you apply that to awareness. You see, awareness is like space and the body and the feelings of like and dislike and the thoughts and the emotions and the sights and the sounds and tastes and bodily feelings and smells, all of that are like the form. So you have awareness is like space, and then the sense experience is like form. And then you try to pray, you try to like use that metaphor, you don't just think about it. Because that, if you try to figure it out, you just be intellectual. So I know Ajahn Sumedho was once teaching in this way. There was another monk who was had a strong background in physics and got into an argument about space. Space bends and so on. It was a totally intellectual argument. He just kind of, Ajahn Sumedho says, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about physics. But so you might, you know, you might try that, like when you're, you know, as you're meditating, get a sense of that that there is space in the mind, just by opening the mind. So I find listening kind of brings me to that sense of space. When you like, if you're doing body awareness, get a sense of like the body in space, large, or take like Agnes Martin's idea of take a horizontal line to infinity. Imagine yourself on a beach, and there's the horizon, and the water goes out infinitely from the beach, or something like that, or just space and form, and then you start to get it kind of intuit that awareness has no real boundaries. Thought, you know, thought is bounded, and the body's bounded, but awareness has no boundaries. So you get these ideas of boundlessness. You apply that, say, to the metta practice. Metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, kindness, compassion, gladness, and equanimity. You apply, you know, take that idea of boundlessness. Boundless compassion, no limits. You start to use metaphor and language and imagination to get the mind away from this constant grasping and localizing and being caught up with a strong sense of self. You kind of really open the mind. And this isn't getting spaced out. this can be done quite skillfully. So then, the image then is that the feelings of mind body are rising and ceasing in space, whereas the really kind of contracted and ego oriented sort of sense of self is I am someone in the brain, and I'm noticing you out there. And on some level, that's true, that you, I am here and you are there. But on the other level, it's true that all this is taking place in awareness. And not that we have to go into some argument about consciousness, but it's actually a kind of a doing. We actually do that. We try to try that out. Space, boundless space. And what does that do for you? And for some people, that works very, very well. Some people doesn't. They can't figure it out, or so they feel much more grounded with something concrete, something very earthed, like the breath. But both also. People who's somehow they get too willful with the breath, and they get really kind of contract, that they like that sense of space. And that sense of space and form leads to practices like what we call choiceless awareness, or the sound of silence. That's very, very much like that. So the sound of silence is like when you let go of localizing your attention, and when you can relax the mind into a kind of open awareness, and where there is no desire, where there is no grasping of objects, no infatuation with objects. It's just simply relaxing back into awareness of the way things are. Then in that kind of relaxed state of openness, oftentimes one senses a kind of background sound, a ringing sound, electronic sound, many ways to describe it. And that's a very fruitful thing to relax into. It's a kind of a sign that the mind is not grasping objects, and the mind is relaxed in the sense of non-attachment. So that is, some people find that very, very helpful, just to notice that. Again, people hear about that and they think, oh, I have to find a sound, and they get greedy and they start grasping, and that's totally what this is not meant to be. So in some sense you say to people, well, whatever I've told you, forget about it. You don't even think about it. Don't give it a second thought. Because as soon as one makes any kind of concrete suggestions of what can happen or what you can get, the mind immediately remembers that and tries, you know, oh, I have to get this or that. But what are you going to say? You're going to say something. So that sound of silence is many of Ajahn Sumedho's disciples like to use that, relaxing back into that. And so choiceless awareness also is one that you find in many traditions. And basic is just being aware of the way things are. So there is a choice, and that's the choice to be present to the way things are. But there isn't a kind of intentional focusing on a particular object. There isn't an intentional localizing of attention on a particular object. So the mind just is in a state of awareness of change, things coming and going. And a lot of people find that easier than focusing on the breath. But all in all, I think the capacity to understand how those practices of like emptiness, sound of silence, and the practices of like choosing specific objects like the breath or animitta or the metta practice, to actually have the skill to use all of those is very fruitful. And which do you do? Well, I think just you try one for a year. If you try one for 11 days and it doesn't work, so what? You have to kind of invest some time into it. But I think intuitively we kind of get a sense of who we are. So I think most meditators they find a way to stabilize the mind. They get good at that, and they also kind of find a time when the mind is stable enough in the present moment where it's okay to let go of the object of meditation and contemplate the very nature of consciousness, the very nature of self, the very nature of a doer, of a me doing the meditation, the mind looking at the mind. So try to get confidence in developing a kind of consistent way of stabilizing the mind. This would be very helpful, something you can turn to. And it depends a lot on what your energy system is doing at the present moment, what your emotional life is about. It's not just one thing. So sometimes you have something gets triggered and you have a huge upheaval of emotion, then it's really time just to let it go through you, choiceless awareness. Because you don't have to do much, really. It's so powerful, it's just there. Other times you're really dull and passive. You need to do something more vigorous, full of vitality, full of energy. So like sometimes with breath meditation, people are afraid to manipulate the breath. But why not? Why not just go for it? Try deep breathing, try shallow breathing. Because when you take the object of meditation and you just engage it, you just play around with it like a piece of clay. Just try this, you try that. You're not being too passive. And you try really hard. Or you get more spacious, and you make kind of deliberate experiments, and then you start to understand how we know what works for you, what doesn't work for you. So one of the meditators that likes to come here tells me that he learned breath meditation in the Zen temple in Toronto, I think, and they taught him to count his breaths, and he's still been doing that. Just counts his breaths for the first whatever to kind of get in the ball game. But as I was saying earlier, imagine having to do that rest of your life. counting your breaths. It'd be horrible. But as an entryway into breath meditation, he finds it really, really helpful, very skillful. So where's the usefulness of breath meditation? Where's the usefulness of the heart meditation? That's a very important to come to intuitive understanding of the softness of consciousness, the kind of gentleness, the receptivity, the empathy of the mind. That's a very important part to learn about. And that doing those practices, I think also you get an intuition of when your attention is just too harsh, too strident, too sharp, it hasn't got the kind of softness of receptivity. So you learn how to like bring in metta practice into the mindfulness of breathing. May I be well, you be well. So that the awareness is conjoined with empathy. It has a heart quality, because we are heart beings. And then it's much easier to meditate. If your meditation has some kind of heart quality, it's much, much easier to meditate, because it's softer, it's nice, it's pleasant, has a pleasant feeling to it. You can really sustain a lot of practice. But if meditation is just too harsh, too willful, too kind of edgy or whatever, the body gets very tense, and you just don't want to do it, because it doesn't bring you any kind of pleasant result. So the heart practices, if you think about it, if you bring up like gratitude, like we had the gratitude to Parents' Day here. It's lovely, wasn't it? You're just thinking about my mom. A lot of the building work this year is because of my mom's generosity. So I was thinking about that. Good on you, mom. And just that reflection of someone you love, and you're grateful to that person, you think, oh, it's nice, it's pleasant, isn't it? That's a pleasant thing to do. So then how do you introduce that very pleasantness into a meditation practice, rather than think meditation is just like this awful hard work all the time, and then you're just kind of struggling with your dukkha. Sometimes it is, but it doesn't have to be. Sometimes it has to be, but oftentimes it's just the attitude that we bring to it. So bringing kind of like just feeling what it feels like to be empathetic to someone, to feel gratitude towards someone, to feel just goodwill to someone. Say like with the example of Andy and the chainsaw. I could if I didn't know that who Andy was, I think, oh, who is this bloke using his chainsaw? And all of a sudden, I find out that Andy should be dead, and he's got considerable challenges, and he's got this chainsaw up in the air, and amazing, isn't it? And so your whole attitude softens to him, doesn't it? So that, and then apply that to yourself, just like you can have a kind attitude to the sound of the chainsaw, because you understand the person running it has his challenges. In the same way, the chainsaw of your mind, the kind of whatever is buzzing in your mind, can you bring a kind of softer attitude to that? So like, let's say I'm feeling annoyed at someone, say, oh, poor Viradhammo is annoyed again. Rather than, there you go, you're annoyed again, Viradhammo. That's got that edge to it, doesn't it? So like humor's very good, isn't it? Just like you're kind of really getting off on something and just make it ridiculous. Bring humor in. So the heart practices are this kind of softening, and they have a kind of pleasant quality to them. Pleasant. Very nice to be generous, isn't it? To offer generosity. So you can see, like, if you stabilize the mind with like the breath and metta practice, and then that becomes, you don't have to do it so deliberately. You don't have to kind of, now I'm doing the breath practice, and now I'm doing metta practice, as if they are somehow separate. you know, now I'm eating apples and now I'm eating gherkins. I would say gherkins. But rather to see once you understand what that softness is and what that stability is, they begin to be one piece, which isn't just some kind of a technique, not just a technique. So then as that way of stability and open-heartedness stabilizes the mind in this way, then the capacity to really observe more subtle things, like the very sense of a doer, your sense of a self doing something, the mind turning on the mind, or the relaxation into the sound and silence, that's all there. So the development of your own meditation practice is very, 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 very particular, but don't be afraid to experiment, and please don't get kind of caught into the trap of thinking I can't meditate. That's not a kind of a good place to go. You just say, well, okay, this is what I'm going to meditate with. I'm going to try to be mindful with this particular condition. And then you're meditating. You may not think you're successful, but don't worry about success. Just meditate, because that's what we do. You know, this is our duty as Buddhist practitioners. We meditate for the sake of meditating, not for success or insight. They take care of themselves. You just kind of lay the foundation. Ajahn Sumedho used to teach a lot like that when we were in Thailand. The early years in Thailand, we were some pretty strong characters. And we were quite a determined group of men. And he would constantly try to mellow that kind of determination. But just keep laying a foundation. Just trust that. Just do what's right. Live by the precepts. Stabilize the mind with anapanasati. Open the heart with metta bhavana. Just keep laying the foundation. And the rest will take care of itself. Which is a more humble kind of way of operating. And then, however, you know, wherever or however the fruit falls, that's kind of... you don't have to worry about that, because you're doing laying the right foundation. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.